What I do in my book is try to provide a framework, a kind of box to put a lot of those stories. I'm not a storyteller. I am a kind of big picture guy. And I like putting up this big framework. But without those stories, of course, it doesn't mean anything. And what I do, what I hope to do, is to give some way of framing your stories and putting together many stories in a way that makes sense, that makes sense to you and makes sense to other people who live in this place and beyond. Because I think we have a lot to say. I think we have a lot to say about contemporary America and contemporary capitalism in the world. Now, this is an extraordinary place. And what I try to do in this book, which was already introduced, I guess I'll say Pictures of a Gone City, which I riffed off of Lawrence Ferlinghetti with that title, is to say, okay, this is the best case for capitalism today. This is the shining star in the firmament of the world economy. No place has done better than us in conventional terms in the last decade. We are the global center of the tech industry. We are one of the fastest growing places, the fullest employment, the richest, the most dynamic, the most innovative. And yet, there's so much that's going wrong. So I thought by looking at this one place, I would provide a framework for your stories, and I would also provide a window into larger things that are going on in the country and in the world. Because obviously we're not absolutely unique, even though the Bay Area, the story of the Bay Area is worth telling because it's unique enough to tell ourselves and others that this is a really interesting and important place. But it has its bright side and its ugly side. And Carrie spoke of the paradoxes. And the paradoxes are really striking and sometimes appalling. So I try to do several things in this book. And roughly, I start out by talking about the economy, the economic base, growth, prosperity, and all that. And then I talk about enrichment and inequality and class and race, the social order of the city. And then after that, I have a whole section on how this works out spatially. What's the geography of this and why does it matter? And in fact, how is it the way most of us see all these phenomena being worked out, these sort of abstract forces, work out so much through the places, the neighborhoods, the towns we live in. And finally, the last part, I look at a set of challenges, like the fact that this podium is rolling. There are little challenges and big ones, so I'll stop leaning on it. The challenges for the future, and I look at environment condition of climate change, the living in tech world, and what to do about it, and our political future. Now, I can't cover all that, but I'll try to cover the basics in this time allotted. Now, start with the economy. Oh, and I should say, what I tried to do throughout is say, okay, here's the facts, and I have charts and facts until they're coming out your ears, though it's surprisingly readable. And then try to show the mythologies that go along with this, the ideologies, as we old lefties used to say, and then do a critique and kind of look beneath that at the reality that's often very unpleasant. So if we look at the economy, the economic base, okay, we are the most important center of the most important industry in the world today, that is electronics, the internet, what we call high tech or tech. And there's no place comparable to this. Everybody wants to be Silicon Valley, although they don't realize that the whole Bay Area practically is Silicon Valley now, especially the West Bay, San Francisco, the peninsula, Silicon Valley, parts of the East Bay have been consumed by the greater growth of this electronics industry. Now, there's a mythology about this which says that, you know, this is all due to a bunch of geniuses, a bunch of really clever startups and the brilliant Mark Zuckerberg and all these nerds and so on. And that's just basically wrong. That's just like the frosting on the cake. And it's a very deep layered cake made up of a huge number of firms that create these immense agglomeration economies. That's a boring term that we economic geographers use, but very real, that when you have a mass of companies and workers and so on in one place, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. We also have 100 years of technical development in this amazing technology of electronics. So these guys that kind of roll in here and come up with their little Facebook or whatever it is are not so brilliant. They're just toying with the edge of this immense platform, as it were. And we're very lucky to have that. But at the same time, this mythology of the startups and the little guys and, you know, you can come here and change the world. It's great for capitalism. It makes capitalism fun again, right, as one writer put it. But it's terribly misleading, because actually what's gone on is that we've developed some of the biggest monopolies, corporate monopolies in the world. That we are, this is no different than San Francisco in the Gilded Age with the Big Four or the Silver Kings. This is the Gilded Age all over again, and these companies like Google and Facebook and Twitter and so on make immense monopoly profits because they so dominate their field of action. There isn't that much competition. And when there is a new startup that's very clever, they swallow it. So they've each swallowed 20, 50, 100 other companies. And those monopoly profits are part of the next point I want to make, which is, are we rich because we're so clever? Well, not necessarily. We have a lot of clever people, a lot of clever firms. We invent a lot of things here. The world has been essentially transformed by the technologies that have been developed in the Bay Area. You know, that is not an exaggeration to say that. At the same time, we get a lot of extra benefits. We bring in labor, the brain power, and the labor from around the world to work here, and we don't have to pay a dime for it. It's the miracle of immigration. And by the way, it doesn't just work for poor Mexicans. It works for very well-educated French people and Germans and Chinese who get educated somewhere else, come here and work in these high-tech companies, do a startup, or come in and do all the ordinary work, which I'll get back to. We also, of course, we gain unbelievable amounts of loose capital. The world economy hasn't actually done that well. You may remember something called the Great Recession that clobbered the world and left an enormous amount of money floating around. And because the banks were allowed to survive, the rich were allowed to survive, there's immense wealth out there that doesn't know what to do with its money. It starts with our own corporations. Apple has $200 billion in cash reserves. If that doesn't speak to monopoly profits, I don't know what does. The five biggest tech companies have $500 billion stowed away in overseas bank accounts to avoid taxes. But it's not just them. There's money coming from Latin America, from China, from Europe, from all over the US that flows into this place and invests in tech stocks. Puts together REITs, real estate investment trust, to invest in apartment buildings and office buildings all around the Bay Area, because this is the hottest place in the world. This is the hottest market. And we don't know yet how much money has flowed in because there aren't good statistics. But there's a lot of good hints. And back in the bubble of the 90s, the dot-com bubble, I did a calculation after it blew up that showed that 40% of the bubble in the stock market which at that time was the greatest stock market bubble in history. We've exceeded it now. 40% of it was in 100 Bay Area companies. And when it blew up, very noteworthy companies like Intel and Cisco, that are still with us, it's not just silly dot-com companies, their stock value shrank by 95 to 99%. And yet here's Apple, the first trillion-dollar corporation, and the tech companies, the big, you know, the big tech companies, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, and you can throw in Netflix and others, you know, the fangs, as they're called, are the most valuable corporations in the world. So when you see today that the stock values of the tech companies sank a bit in the last week, look out, because there's an awful lot of fluff there. There's an awful lot of excess money. There's a lot of credit speculation based on loans and a cheap credit environment over the last 10 years. So the whole thing is kind of puffed up. We get these huge influxes of people and money, and we're not as brilliant as we think. And the people in the places where the steel firms closed and the car plants closed, they're not as dumb as we think. You know, they got hit by history, and we are on history's, you know, good in history's good graces for the moment. But of course, the other thing you have to point out, whenever there's a boom, they always predict it'll go on forever. This is the longest recovery in American history, blah, blah, blah. Well, damn right it's the longest recovery in American history, because the Great Recession was one of the greatest collapses in American history, and it takes a very long time to crawl out of that. And we're finally supposedly at full employment nationally. And you know, all you hear from the mainstream press is, and economists is, yeah, this is great, this is gonna go on forever. When they start saying that, you know we're in trouble. Because capitalist booms become bubbles, they pop, and they collapse. Some of them are spectacular, like 2008, 2009. Some of them are more modest. The dot-com bubble killed us, but didn't make too many ripples elsewhere. So they vary. They vary in their intensity, their geography, and so on. But it'll come, and when it comes, we won't look quite as brilliant as we look now. Okay, what's the social order that's being developed in this boom, in this incredible growth? Well, we are now the richest metropolitan area on Earth. And I'm talking about the Bay Area now. And that's big enough that it's a little hard for us to get our heads around it when we sit in San Francisco or Berkeley or Santa Rosa, where I spoke yesterday. But at the same time, it's not so big that we can't understand it. It's 8.5 million people. It goes 75 to 100 miles in every direction except west from San Francisco. It's huge. Okay, this metropolitan area, not San Francisco, not Silicon Valley, has an average median income of $100,000 per person per year. No place else is close. What's more, and of course the mythology is, okay, we're so prosperous that it must mean that everybody's doing great. No, it means that some of the people are doing great, that not everybody isn't doing great. And as we know, the mythology, the old capitalists saw that, a rising tide lifts all boats is not true. So what we have in the Bay Area is we are some of the leaders in the creation of inequality in the country, maybe in the world, because we're the place that produces some of the greatest volcanoes of wealth flowing into the pockets of the owners of these corporations, the owners of stock, the owners of land, of property, anywhere in the world. We have more billionaires on the Forbes list of 400 billionaires. We have 50 of them. Only New York has more, but it's a lot bigger than us. So per capita, they have more billionaires per square foot, per acre, however you want to put it, per capita, than any place in the world, with the possible exception of Hong Kong, because all the Chinese billionaires go to Hong Kong. or a lot of them. We also have more one percenters. There's various ways to measure this. Our top 5% is way out of whack with any other city in the US. Our top 20% has been doing very well. The professionals, the technical workers, the managerial workers, people that look like me. And they're white, by the way. They're overwhelmingly white men with a smattering of women and Asians and here and there a person of color. But we know that they're overwhelmingly of the favored. And so the top 20% is doing great, and that is what raises the median. But down below, what's going on? Well, the bottom quarter, 25th to a quarter, are earning only minimum wage in this, the richest place on earth. A 30, 35%, maybe a third, roughly, are not even earning the a living wage, given the cost of living here, which is so high. So we have a huge, what used to be, what we really should call a cheap labor force. It's huge here. And actually the middle, the working middle class, around the 50%, has been shrinking, just like the rest of the US, despite our incredible wealth and high income. So it's a real mixed bag. It's a real paradoxical, it's a real split distribution. And who are those people and the workers? Okay, we hear a lot about the rich guys, and we hear a lot about the techies and the professionals, and they're great. You know, there's a lot of really brilliant people. Although techies, an awful lot of techies are more exploited than you might think. Even though those, you know, those wonderful digs they are in where you get free beer and free games and childcare, that's so you'll stay there for 10, 12 hours a day, sleep under your desk, because that's the work ethic. But, of course, that's still better than being poor and exploited, and we have lots of those. And that's not even to talk, and the whole system wouldn't operate without those people. They are the childcare workers, the health workers, the transport workers, the food service workers, the workers in hotels, and so on and so on, the construction workers. And the whole system would not function without them, though they don't get much credit for it. You hear about the great innovators and the nerds, but what about ordinary workers? And boy, are they exploited. And then, of course, there's a whole giant penumbra that Apple and the other major corporations have of people, of workers around the world. I mean, Apple has operations, subcontracts its actual production operation. You know, Apple's just a designer and a sales firm and a management firm, but its operations, for example, like iPhones, are produced in Shenzhen by Foxconn, by some of the most exploited workers in the world. Well, and some of that surplus value, by the way, comes right back home to the Bay Area. So we have this interesting phenomenon in which we have a lot of low-wage labor. We're not as much a low-wage economy as, say, Miami or Atlanta. But we still have a huge low-wage labor force, which is interesting because you think, oh, well, you know, capitalism, it can overcome that. It doesn't need that. It can pay well. No, they always want it. And even Facebook, which brags that their average worker makes $250,000 a year, they conveniently forget that they subcontract all their food service, their cleaning, their security, their trucking, all the other things in which people are earning minimum wage or crappy wages. And that would drag down those really lovely figures they like to parade. And what's interesting in all this, what's happened in California, above all, of all the United States, is, of course, the transformation of the working class. And of course, you know, working class is an old left term, and class, you know, in my lifetime, the first time that class became a word that people beyond the left, the hard left, would even start to talk about was the Occupy Wall Street movement, the one percenters, thanks really to a lot of great research by a bunch of French economists. Because Americans don't like to talk about class, you know. We only talk about income. Though if it makes you feel any better or worse, we have the income distribution of Guatemala in the Bay Area. So anyway, we have a class structure, but of course it's riven by gender divides, racial divides, you know. But it's interesting, our working class today is overwhelmingly people of color. It's two-thirds. In California, two-thirds, in places, three-quarters, people of color, immigrants, their children, African-Americans, a smattering of Native Americans, and so on. It's a very different world. And you know, in the old days, you'd say the term working class, you still hear this in the East. Oh yeah, that's those white coal miners in West Virginia. Well, no, it ain't. That's not who the workers are today. In California, it's total transformation, who the working class is, and what the struggles are, because the key struggles are not only for the fight for 15 and unions, which are going on, you know, strongly, vigorously here and around California, but also Black Lives Matter, decriminalization, trying to break up the prison complex, and of course, immigrant rights, stop our children and our nephews and our cousins from being deported for no good reason. And those are the struggles from below. Those are the struggles that are changing California, making California more liberal, more of a blue state. There is a kind of fiction, which I get to at the end of the book, that because we have so many really educated, wonderful professionals with a lot of, you know, kind of socially liberal, much more socially liberal on average, I think our top 20% than most of the U.S. outside of, say, New York and Boston. But the thing that's really turned California blue is not all the smart intellectuals like me. Well, I can call myself that. Left intellectuals and lefties. It's the working class. It's the new working class. And those people vote after a quarter century of being one of the major centers of neoliberalism, neoconservatism in America, some of the most recidivist, backward policies of any place in this country. California, remember, we produced Reagan, Nixon. Yeah, we have a lot to answer for. And around the turn of the millennium, something happened. We became blue. And that's because of the working class. That's because immigrants couldn't stand the Republicans after Prop 187. They learned a hard lesson there because California got so reactionary, just like the country is now. The good news is that California has turned around to a very remarkable degree. Somebody who's lived since that time, since the early 90s, when we were the leaders of anti-immigrant xenophobia. So hallelujah for that, and let's hope it happens to the rest of the country. Now, I want to get to, in the 10 minutes or so I've got left, right? I want to say what's the impact of this on the city, on the urban, make up the city, the urban landscape, as we geographers like to say. And it's turned the city, and in the large sense of the metropolis, upside down. And David Harvey, a great urban geographer, great Marxist geographer, said years ago that capitalism remakes the cities, its cities, in its own image, to its own needs, every generation, every boom. There are new functions, new kinds of labor forces, new modes of consumption, and capitalism tries its very best, and usually succeeds, in remaking cities to its own image. And we've seen that throughout the history of modernity. So Paris was very functional in the Second Empire. New York, in the middle of the 20th century, fantastically functional to be the king of the hill, the new pinnacle of finance, and so on. Well, the Bay Area is being remade for the tech boom, for this great, vast economic boom that's going on right now. Now, one of the most obvious manifestations of that is things are just being knocked down, torn up, and new buildings going up everywhere. And people see that and they go, what the hell? You know, cities change. And of course, it's an old saw of urban geographers that cities change all the time. They're a very dynamic system. But this is crazy dynamic. This is the dynamism of capitalism running faster and faster down the track and about to go off the rails, as it always does. It's the manic, excessive change driven by the mania of capitalism. Now, of course, there's all kinds of cultural adjuncts to that. You know, Americans just adore technology and have for 200 years. There's whole books written about the American technological sublime. But it's driven by capital and its need to make money by forever coming up with new products and new processes, new modes of communication, and all the rest. So you see that, and it's tearing up our lives, and a lot of people look around and say, my God, this is not much the city I knew. Fortunately, cities are more resilient and people are more resilient than often we think. So oftentimes when people are in despair about how San Francisco or Oakland are changing, they forget a lot of people, when the dust settles, a lot of the people are still going to be there. The people we know, the people are still fighting. The second thing we see, of course, is this, what we call gentrification. And on a neighborhood-to-neighborhood basis, gentrification's a good word. But what it really is the colonization or the conquest of space by the top 20%. They want to be near their jobs in tech on the West Bay, near the new firms in San Francisco, near finance, whatever it may be. And they have the money. And the rest of people don't. And the people with the money get to choose in a market, housing market system. So they move to be near their jobs, they take the apartments, they buy the houses, and they, I put that in quotation marks, drive out literally tens and hundreds of thousands of working people and working families who then flee to Daly City, down the peninsula, but there's not much refuge there, across to Oakland, but then that's changing rapidly. Then it's out to Antioch, Pittsburgh, and on out to Stockton, Modesto, and beyond. People are commuting 2 hours each way, some people. We have the highest percentage of long-distance commutes of any metropolis in America. So you have this mass displacement and gentrification, transformation of the core cities, Oakland getting all kind of spruced up in certain parts, and a lot of the older population, working people, African Americans, being displaced. Of course, the foreclosure crisis helped this process along. So crises often also remake the city. It's not just booms. But right now I'm talking about the boom. So you have massive displacement and a remaking of the city as a playground for the upper classes. And, you know, we are sine qua non of that, if that's the right term, I hope. Anyway, and then, you know, then we have what we call the housing crisis. It's not a housing crisis for the top 20%. It's a housing crisis for the bottom 75-80% because they can't afford to live here. Our housing prices, our rents, our houses, well, nobody can afford a house anymore, so they all, so rental, percentage of rentals in the Bay Area is now at about, it's well over 60%. So I think it's up going up. Like San Francisco's always been kind of a renter city because it was expensive, central land, dense. Well, the whole Bay Area is becoming like that. But the rents here are higher than metropolitan New York, higher than Boston, higher than Washington, higher than London. They're some of the highest, they've been amongst the highest in the country. Depends on how you add them up, divide it. But they've been right there in the top, usually right at the top, for the duration of this boom. They're probably the most expensive, some of the most expensive in the world, and some of the most unaffordable. The only cities in the world more unaffordable than us are Singapore and Vancouver. Which means that only 20% of the people can afford the median-priced house. And in San Francisco, of course, it's more like 5%. In Inner East Bay, it's probably like 10%. So it's unaffordable. So no wonder people can't live here and they're being driven out. And of course, the landlords and the investors, there are small landlords and then there are the big investor landlords. They come in, grab big buildings, and force everybody out. Oh, and they've got all kinds of shady ways of doing that. So they're active players. Don't ever believe that property investors are passive good deed doers providing housing. You know, most of them are in it for the money because that's what capitalism is about, a commercial society. We're in it for the money, as one of the storytellers in Gary's book said. So that's our housing crisis, and I'll finish on the last myth, which I just have to hit. There is this profound mythology that the reason housing prices are so high in the Bay Area, so high in California, is because of you. This is your fault. Didn't know you were that important, did you? Yeah, this is the YIMBY view of the world, the yes in my backyard. The view is it's the NIMBYs. It's popular opposition to development. Unreasonable popular opposition that's stopping, making it impossible. How many times do you see quotes from developers? It's impossible to build in San Francisco, in the East Bay, in wherever it is, in Berkeley, and yada, yada, yada. Well, first of all, it doesn't have anything to do with supply. Okay, there's demand and supply. I think this is so funny because you kind of say, well, you know, it's a market, supply and demand. And if demand is high, then you've got to increase supply. Okay, that's true. In the long run, you need to increase supply. Big cities get denser, they get higher. That is going to happen. That's kind of normal growth, the normal functioning of a land market. But land markets don't behave normally in booms. They do that. And then they collapse, and then they bubble, and then they collapse. Anybody remember the collapse at the Great Recession? What did that have to do with housing, mortgage finance? Okay. Yeah, it does happen. I know it comes as a shock, because in 10 years, Americans forget all history. But the problem is demand is so excessive. It's run up so fast in the richest place in the world, on average, with incredible inequality, growing inequality, in which only the top 20% can actually afford anything. And if any housing is built, by the way, it's built for those people, because that's where the profits are. So in that kind of hothouse, of course prices have shot through the moon. There's no way, no housing market on earth can supply housing fast enough to satisfy that extreme, exaggerated, perverse, bubble kind of condition. Now, how about the supply side? Is it really you? Is it really the opposition? No. It takes a long time to build houses. It takes a long time to build skyscrapers. Salesforce Tower just got built. Salesforce has been a power in data management for corporate management for a decade. And now their building is finally finished. It takes a long time because you gotta get property, you gotta get finance, you gotta get the engineers, and you gotta get the architects and the design and the permits and all that. And the tenants, and it takes a long time. But you know, guess what? By 2015, housing was being built at a very snappy pace in the Bay Area, contrary to all rumors. I don't know about you, but have you noticed all the new condominiums in Berkeley? It's like, oh, nothing's being built in Berkeley? I mean, this is a complete joke. And it turns out that if you look at the data across cities, we're above average. At worst, we're only average. But we've built more housing proportionately than a lot of big cities like Chicago and New York. The only ones we haven't built faster than are cities where there are no regulations and no rules and no nothing, like Houston, where a third of the new houses have gone underwater last year. I don't think we want to do that. Now, it's not to say there aren't silly NIMBYs, and there are definitely exclusive enclaves like Orinda and Palo Alto that do not take their fair share of housing. That is absolutely true. There's a lot of space eaten up by those those enclaves of the rich. But what's ironic is we have these enclaves of the wealthy and the white, which have been doing this for decades, for a century at least. And when the Mission District or downtown Berkeley flatlands, there's some protest over a development, everybody gets hysterical and says, oh, how dare you? People defend their turf. They have a right to oversee, regulate, protest changes in their environment. And they darn well better control developers, because otherwise you'll just get a lot of really bad housing in the wrong places, in the wrong way. So on that note, I'm going to say that we face a lot of challenges in the Bay Area. This is not an easy time. I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned here. If I had more time, I could go into what we're doing right in terms of getting rid of Costa Hawkins, if we can, and getting rent control again to slow this down. Because the most important thing in a housing bubble is to slow the train down before it runs you over. So rent control, vacancy control, that's absolutely essential. And regulation, permit regulation, all that stuff matters. You've got to slow things down when it's like this. Which is not to say you can not build anything. You will build it. You have to build it. But it's got to be good. It's got to be in the right place. It's got to be done reasonably. All right, on that note, I'll finish. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you both. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, all right.
So many different layers to the story of the Bay Area, and as Dick was emphasizing, also the scope of it geographically. But one of the things that that you touched on, Dick, and that you channel in your book Silicon City, are is the perspective of those in the elite and their self-perception and their ideology and their sense of themselves as progressive people who are, you know, open-minded and embracing diversity, and they really can't figure out, you know, what's all the animus directed against them. What did you find, Carrie, when you talked to people? Because in your book, it brings together voices that we would find more familiar, at least for a KPFA audience, the activists, the artists, but you also spoke to venture capitalists and people from that elite. How did they see their role in all of this?
It's a great question. This is working great. That's a great question. There is not a monolithic community within tech. And I think the voices that feel most removed from the experiences that you considered more familiar to the KPFA audience are certainly those with levers over finance and money, in a way where they are eager to pull that lever. They feel like it is the solution they can offer to the problem. And they are eager to use their influence in government and elsewhere to transform the city in an image that they consider benevolent and positive. And that's, I think, the empathetic read on that point of view. The point of view I think I'm more interested in is the sort of daily grind worker, programmer, engineer, even people who are leading teams and doing very exciting work. Many of these people are at a place where their financial situation is right on the cusp of what the economy is allowing them to sort of thrive and do. So rents are continuing to rise to eat their marginal income. They are commuting back and forth to a tech campus every day. They work long hours. They feel an obligation to put their kids through public schools, which puts to private schools, which puts pressure on the public schools. And there are all kinds of political consequences of that behavior. But that point of view means that they see the problems in a city around them, and they don't know how to free themselves, in many cases, to be able to do liberated work in the community. And so there's a tremendous amount of talent that I think the tech industry is sort of absorbing by its just sheer busyness, by just not being able to give smart people who have arrived into the community the ability to be able to be civically engaged in their neighborhoods and to be able to take the time to be able to invest what they know how to do. That is, I think even those people who are finding themselves investing in the long term, building companies, and are able to take a different perspective around their company's role in San Francisco, are finding that they just don't have enough allies for the work that they're doing as well. So there's a loneliness, I think, in that community that's expressed, whether it's at the very top, and they feel like, I won't quote the people in the book for now, because their words speak on their own, but they feel that they are misunderstood. I feel like, and that is, I think, expressing part of what a dynamic Richard explored in his talk, which is capitalism is just consuming everybody's ability to have an opportunity to turn this around, even on the tech side.
Did you want to add to that?
Sure.
But we only have two mics.
Yeah, that is, in some ways, a $64,000 question, just to date myself, is which way the tech industry, the tech workers and all, are going to go politically. I do think there have been some absolutely false hopes that the tech capitalists were somehow a new breed and they support the Democrats and progressive politics. I just don't think that's true. I think on a personal level, yeah, a lot of them are young, and therefore, like a lot of young Americans, they're less racist, less sexist, and less xenophobic and homophobic than older Americans. But when it comes to economic policy, they are libertarian. And they don't like government. They think they can do it all. And they're utopian in the sense that they think their brilliance and their technology can solve all problems. And I think they're absolutely wrong about that. There was, you know, Fred Turner wrote a wonderful book about the melding of the counterculture and the Cold War cyber culture into, the planning for military work that went on in Silicon Valley, into the kind of culture of the nerds, of the progressive, adventurous, free-thinking tech people of the late 20th century. And there's a lot to that. I mean, they have a lot of roots in Bay Area openness and bohemian culture, counterculture, and so on. But once they become big capitalists, boy, they become big capitalists. And, you know, we don't know what Henry Ford was like. He was kind of a cranky engineer when he was young. But by the time he was old, he was a terrible proto-fascist. William Randolph Hearst, the favored child of George Hearst and Phoebe Hearst, was a kind of progressive newspaper man when he started and ended up as another proto-fascist. So these guys, you know, not a one of them raised a peep against the Republican tax cuts. Mark Benioff, at least, is now saying, supporting Prop C in San Francisco, saying we ought to pay higher taxes to help with homelessness. But then you look at Jeff Bezos. They had a similar proposition in Seattle, and he's crushed it. And then he turns around and says, oh, I think I'll give $1 billion for housing and homelessness. And you want to smack him and say, no, pay your damn taxes, and then we'll talk about philanthropy. As for the rest of the techies, I think you're right. A lot of them are misunderstood. I don't think we should ever prejudge them. There are a lot of people in San Francisco and elsewhere unhappy with them, because a lot of them do come from upper-class universities. They're frat boys, they're Yale guys, and as we know from Brett Kavanaugh, those are not always the nicest people. And they come with a lot of arrogance. But there are plenty of other really smart people, and one of the tragedies, I think, of our time, or maybe delights of our time, is one of the interesting things of history is how talent gets funneled into certain adventures, certain enterprises at certain points in history. I mean, if you're a talented upper child of the educated anyway, in Austria, late 18th century Austria, you want to write sonatas. I mean, think of the flowering, or if in the early 20th century, you're doing philosophy in Vienna. But what do we do today? Our best and the brightest come and do apps. And that is perhaps not the best use of their talent. You know, when the New Deal was around, the best and the brightest often went to work for the WPA and the CCC and Harry Hopkins and Franklin Roosevelt.
You're holding on to that.
I got it.
Well, just following up on that about the tech workers, it's very easy and very frequently the tech workers and the tech owners are conflated into one group, you know, the tech people.
Right.
And often it's actually, even on the left, it's sort of hard to stop and separate them out and see them as different groups that actually don't have the same interests, even though culturally one might make assumptions about them being similar. And yet it's actually the tech workers who are the most visible, you know, whether on scooters or whatever, and, you know, the easy target of a lot of ire. And is that a mistake that particularly, and I guess for people organizing around these questions, should we be thinking more about how we can reach out to the tech workers? Because one of I wish I had the fact at my fingertips, but that you quote in Pictures of a Gone City is some very substantial number of tech workers in the Bay Area gave to the Bernie Sanders campaign, which certainly surprised me.
Oh, and are still involved with political organizing through, you know, usually through what they know, the technology, companies that are helping candidates, helping women get elected, and so on. So there is a lot of that. And you know, I'm from the ecumenical left, and I think we need everybody, and we need to reach across some of these divides whenever possible.
Yeah, I think we're missing the opportunity to recognize that there are some movements, and they're smaller, but they're important. There's the Tech Workers Coalition, which I think is doing really important organizing work around unionizing in the Bay. I think we have a certain vision of a certain kind of tech worker that traditionally works for some of the major companies, but there are many people who are doing hardware work or doing any number of work for smaller companies who have a very different salary profile and a very different life in the community. I think it's a mistake for us to sort of, as absurd and silly as like a series of men with top knots wandering around on skateboards and scooters around San Francisco can feel, it's not a fair description of a community of people who work hard and are trying to figure out. The challenge we're having is a structural challenge. The challenge is there's a ton of money coming to the Bay Area. It's being captured at the top. There's a group of people who are being asked to sacrifice. They are all working, the working class in the Bay Area. And there is no coordinated mechanism for asking for sacrifice in other areas in a way that would be fair or make an impact. And absent that, you know, there's a failure of the public sector and a failure of the region to sort of rally around real solutions right now. And absent those things, I think we just, everybody's individual solution is either a personal compromise that they have or an experiment they're making in their own organization, their own ability to organize in their own community or their own neighborhood. And there's heroic things being done as a result. Each of our books documents them in different ways, but those heroic things are, you know, shouting against a tidal wave. So.
And there's an enormous amount of innovative ideas in public policy, public politics at the local level, right up to the state level, things that are within our scope to influence. You know, we may despair about what goes on in Washington, but we have a lot of influence right up through Sacramento and California. You know, it's the fifth largest economy in the world. It has a lot of political clout, a lot of cultural influence, and it had a huge amount of influence in turning the world to the neoliberal right back in the late 20th century, and we're still in the process of turning that back to a reasonable, progressive, minimally social democratic, progressive kind of political entity that invests in infrastructure, that has reasonable taxation of property and income and wealth. And we haven't, you know, that isn't locking up all our young brown and black men and so on. And we've come some way on that, but we haven't actually undone all the damage that was done for 25 years in the late 20th century. There is something we can work on. And there are innovative thinkers. There are people who really know how to do good, low-income public housing. There are wonderful homeless services being offered. There are some very innovative programs here. It's not like we don't know anything about it. Transportation, innovative transportation with bicycles and even possibly scooters, and how parking plans and car plans and public transportation investment. But we don't invest anything in public transport. Do you know that LA just passed an $120 billion bond issue for public transit? And what did we do? $5 billion for BART. So we're way behind, actually. And so there's a lot we can do and a lot, I think, that is happening. But we got to keep pushing it forward.
Yeah, I think what makes me most anxious is you can't build a public infrastructure system by startup, and you can't solve health inequities through philanthropy alone. There's a lot of reliance, particularly philosophically, through many of the leaders in the tech sector, on public-private partnership, on social impact solutions, on philanthropy, on individual giving. All of those are meant to innovate at the margin of a center of gravity policy-wise that has already been established, has momentum, and is doing good work and doing the work that it's intended to do. Ideas then are supposed to come in from the margin from all these other places. And there's this, that model has been inverted over these years as more and more reliance on the private sector to throw money in various random directions to try to innovate new solutions, but none of them can get traction because there isn't a place to put that work.
One of the people who you spoke to in your book was Matt Gonzalez, and he, who ran for mayor of San Francisco, and in it he said that tech poses a particular policy challenge because whereas a lot of policies are at city level, the way that tech sort of sprawls octopus-like through the Bay Area has made it so that taxes may go to some cities, and the housing crisis is in other cities, and so there is some need for different kind of regional policies. Do you think that, both of you think that's true, or do you think there really are already the tools in place if there were just the political will to implement them?
I mean, we're seeing something, we're seeing in the Bay Area the reverse of what happened in Detroit and Stockton and other areas. So these are cities that suffered from a tremendous amount of white flight, and county lines and municipal districting meant that income taxes and property taxes were kept outside of the city where it was needed most infrastructure-wise. This is the reverse on some level happening where there's a sort of whitewashing of San Francisco and other urban areas. But somehow still the taxes and the income taxes are being kept in the suburbs, and that's a product of the headquarters of many of these companies being kept in counties where they seize the tax revenue and San Francisco's absent it. That's the sort of devil's bargain in terms of the Twitter tax break was an attempt to keep, you know, whether it was good faith or no, it was argued as an attempt to keep jobs and keep a certain amount of income revenue inside the city. And I don't believe it paid for itself. But so what we're seeing is the problem of regionalism. I mean, when I say, I can't remember if I said this backstage or not, but in New York, we have, the five boroughs are all one city. And so when we need to deal with mass transit problems, or we need to deal with municipal budget issues, or we need to reinvest in public schools, all of us are still thinking about it together. And when people are pushed from Manhattan to an outer borough to Queens or Brooklyn, they still vote in the same municipal county and they still have representation in the same city council. all the injustices exist in New York that exist here. There are some mechanisms for keeping everybody together in a common conversation and providing some minimal representation, keeping that conversation. I think that is fractured through this region in a way that makes it very difficult to fairly allocate resources and negotiate effectively around common problems.
Yeah, obviously, American federalism, and especially in the case of big metropolitan areas, is a mess. And there have been various attempts to get regional government and so on. But it's never worked, because all the local governments guard their turf, you know, with their lives, you know. Particularly because the well-to-do don't want to give up their enclaves. That's the biggest reason. So that's a real puzzle. And we do need, in one way, here and there, to push more regional approaches, like regional fair share housing. It's just something we absolutely need to force these exclusive enclaves to accept more housing, and not force all housing has to be in Oakland and San Francisco and San Jose, which is what Plan Bay Area 2020 said, which was a big mistake. So it's not going to be easy, but we do have to do that. Of course, two things we need is our local governments. We're all bankrupted by Prop 13, so we have to get rid of Prop 13. And that then bankrupted the state, so that the state went into bled red ink every time there's a recession. And California, on the last recession, had a greater deficit than all the other states put together. Because, of course, it has huge government apparatus at the local level that the state's supporting, forced to support, because we don't tax property. And property, including big houses, small houses, is taxation of property is actually progressive. And that's a fact. And you can have safety valve kind of things like you have in utility bills for the little grandmother who's going to lose her home to taxes. You can do that. You don't have to detax all commercial property and all rich people's property, which is what we did with Prop 13. So that was a mistake. I think we also all have to think this is a political question that isn't just solved by this or that fix, governmental fix. You know, that's a kind of technological fixation, too, to think, well, if I come up with the right form of government, it'll all click into place. It's also about how people think and about alliances we have across places to try and get more progressive politics. And we're not, on the left, we're often not that good about that. We're in our bunkers in San Francisco or Oakland or Berkeley, and we don't see beyond that, or, you know, even our neighborhood. And yeah, there's politics to be done at the neighborhood or at Berkeley level, but there's politics to be done much wider region. And we need to pay attention to that because it affects all of us.
I want to ask you both about where you think this will end. There's both the short term and the long term. The short term is we can see another recession coming. So what will that mean for the Bay Area, for all this concentration of wealth, and for all the ills that you both have been talking about? And then longer term, where do you think this will end? Because you mentioned Detroit, capitalism functions in a very geographically uneven way, and that doesn't stop. So one region does very well, but it's not preordained that it stays that way forever. So what is the longer term outlook of the Bay Area?
Okay, well, again, prognostication is not my strong suit. And usually, you know, in a modernism that moves so quickly, anybody who thinks they can make a call beyond even 10 years is delusional. So where will it end? It will come down in a thud. That will, as always, hurt. You know, a lot of companies will lose money, stocks will fall, rich people will moan and groan, but the people that will really smack hardest is always the low-end working people, That's who really gets hurt, and you see it in things like marriage, divorce statistics, suicide, alcoholism, and so on. Or as we see in the part of America that has collapsed over the last 30 years, you know, we get the opioid epidemic. Where do you think that come from? Or crack in the rural areas of California where nothing is actually happening. So that's not good news. I have to say, I mean, I'm always, as a lefty economist type, I'm always cheering for the next recession. And as the old Marxist saw goes, I predicted at least 10 of the last 5 downturns. But it's really going to hurt people, and that's most unfortunate, but that's part of how the system works. And I don't know of a simple way out of that. Now, the thing about the Bay Area is not going to disappear. It's been a center of high tech for a century. It's been fabulously known, well known as Silicon Valley for 40 years. So it's not going to shrivel up and go away. Even though it's way too expensive, that's not going to drive those companies away. These agglomerations have huge staying power, which is why London is still growing 400 years later. So we're not going away. But I do think a lot of people will get hurt. And of course, there are new industries and new places that are rising around the world. We will not be the star of the show, even maybe the next decade. But we'll still be very well off, which means, I think politically what it means is we have the means, we absolutely have to demand more. Demand more from the rich companies and the rich people and our governments. And of course, we have to give the governments the means through taxation. We have to demand more. We have the right to demand more and to use it for the public good, which is something we've forgotten about since the New Deal.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, we have a very short window to try to recapture some of the arbitrary money that's arrived in the Bay Area and has fallen amongst a small class of persons who've been able to capture it. We have a small window to be able to figure out ways to redistribute it and reinvest it towards the public good. The minute a recession arrives, which is sort of inevitable, that opportunity is lost and will freeze whatever changes and demographic changes have occurred now, and a lot of the pain of that moment will fall on the shoulders of those most vulnerable. That feels, unless some magical consensus arrives in the next period of time, like something close to that will probably happen. Over this period of time, there's been a massive redrawing of what work means, what family means, what a home means, what a fair commute means. There's been a unpacking of the social safety net and worker protections and any number of other dignitary protections that were really the inventions of the post-industrial revolution period, where we realized the cruelty that was inflicted upon sort of the common man after that. So now we're arriving at a new place where we're going to do that again. We're going to vacate a lot of that safety net. We're going to vacate a lot of things that we considered crucial to a dignified life and have to redraw that picture again. And that gets us back to very fundamental questions about what does a community mean? Where do we want to live? What responsibilities do we have to each other and to those further away and further away and further away? And I think we have to get back to those fundamental questions again over this period of time and really interrogate whether we're all each doing enough.
Well, speaking of endings, I think I'll end by asking you both the question of what the prospects are for really kind of fundamental transformation or pushing back even against these forces, which, you know, get described as sort of forces beyond our control that we can't do anything about. The Bay Area has obviously a very long history of dissenting and radical politics. Dick, you said that things that populations are more resilient than we realize, that when people are pushed out of one area, they may end up in another but not go away. But on the other hand, one can see, just looking at the history of the left, that it's much harder to, it's much easier to destroy something than create it anew. And of course, the ethos of tech is the silliness of move fast and break things. But in the breaking of things, a certain political culture is being, maybe destroyed is too strong, but it's certainly being damaged. And I guess I would like to end by getting both of your takes on whether you think that this, the culture of, let's just call it the left, the counterculture, bohemia, in the Bay Area is resilient enough to withstand this and be able to sort of come back forcefully.
I'm going to cede the last word to Dick because I remain somewhat of a newcomer and outsider still. I live between New York and here, and I don't particularly have a role to play in terms of defining speaking as an insider yet fully. And the project was nonetheless an attempt to give the diversity of this region and this point of view, the number of points of view inside of it, an opportunity to speak to one another and be heard to people who we all live in our own corners of our own cities, an opportunity for each of us to explore and find points of view that we otherwise wouldn't encounter in our own lives. I'm not arrogant enough to think that that's a world-changing act, but I do hope that those spaces begin to open up more and more here so that there's a kind of collaboration that's possible in the face of the amount of change that's occurring. And I can only hope that given the energy each individual is directing at the problem, that once people are able to find greater connections, and there are places we're seeing that begin to occur, that that can develop the right momentum.
Wow. Well, look, I mean, most of us are very distressed about the state of the world, the state of the country, and the dominant powers of the far right sweeping over this country and dominating Washington. But the fact is that California is the most important part of America. It's by far the largest economic force in this country. And we actually control it. It's a blue state with a liberal legislature and a liberal governor. And the possibilities are enormous if we demand them. And if we don't say, oh, well, I'm sorry, we can't do anything. We actually can do a lot here. And even at local levels, you know, the city of San Francisco is one of the richest fiscal units in America. I don't know, it's right after New York now. So there's a lot of potential in terms of the kind of political demands we could make on ourselves and on the state and use that as a platform for the country. The other thing I'd like to say about that is that, okay, some of the old bohemias and the old left coast that I knew or some of us knew are not there anymore or faded. But new kinds of forces and actors and they're not called bohemias. They're called Daily City, full of Filipinos, Outer Mission, full of workers that are unionized in Local 2 of AGRE, Unite Here. These people, there's a lot going on. This is why LA has actually become more radical, more progressive in many ways in the Bay Area. I'm extremely encouraged by the forces bubbling up from below. And sure, we can see it when it's really obvious, like the wildcat teacher strikes in places like West Virginia and Oklahoma. But there's stuff like that going on in California and in parts of California that, yeah, the Marriott, right? Well, yeah, there's a big strike, the Marriott. But in parts of California that some of us in Berkeley, we don't see as well as we should. That we're a little cloistered in our world here, of an older left, and we need to reach out and see beyond and realize there's a hell of a lot going on out there. It's bubbling, and I think it's bubbling in ways that are going to produce a better future.
All right, well, on that more optimistic note, thanks. Give it up for Richard Walker.